All right, so like, you know, for most of the of this time period, there were controversies, and controversies, and that's that, as we've seen throughout church history, controversies really serve the purpose of allowing us to hone in on what is the truth. And often we don't spend time thinking about the truth until there's something that's aberrant that forces us to take a look at what is the truth. The early church talked very little about the Trinity until a man came along who said Jesus was not God. And it forced the church then to say, what do the scriptures teach? And that was true, too, especially in the northern colonies of Massachusetts and Connecticut. As the first settlers came, those were the only two colonies in New England. Then you added Vermont, then you added New Hampshire, then you added Rhode Island. We're not going to deal with Vermont and New Hampshire now. We'll talk about them later when we get to the Second Great Awakening, because that it plays a part in their lives. But at this point, in fact, next year will be the 200th anniversary of the state of Maine. Eventually, Maine got tired of Massachusetts and separated themselves in 1820. They have an affectionate name for those who are from Massachusetts as well. I'll tell you later. I won't say it now. I don't want it recorded. So the colonies of Massachusetts and Connecticut continue to see these theological controversies arise. And the main difficulty here was that many of these Puritans, while preserving the custom of baptizing children, they were Calvinists, and they believed in the covenant relationship that God has with families. So they were baptizing their children. They were also being affected by Pietism that was putting an emphasis not only on the relationship God makes with us in terms of covenant, but in terms of personal conversion. We sort of look at that and think, well, that's the way it always has been, but that's not the case. All right, so Pietism is playing a role here in shaping the way even the Puritans begin to think about what it means to be a follower of Christ. So they insist on the need of a conversion experience in order to be a true Christian. So the question then becomes, and some of you probably have the same question, well then, what about baptism? Right? What's the significance of baptism if you're insisting on this conversion experience? Would it not be better to wait until a person has experienced conversion and then baptize? See where we're going? That's okay. You were firmly in my mind. This clashed, however, with the Puritan goal of founding a society that was guided by biblical principles, because the Puritans understood that the foundation that God laid in terms of his people, first with national Israel and then with the church, was rooted in this notion that God saves into families. So that the promise, as Luke tells us in Acts 2, the promise is for those who believe and their children. And so what does that mean then for the promises of God to come to us and our children? And so the Puritans understood that building a society on those principles mattered. A Christian commonwealth is conceivable only if one becomes a member of it by birth. It's why we have birthright citizenship here, okay? So the civil and religious communities then are coextensive. And part of the Puritans' problem was that they really wanted to establish a Christian nation. What's the problem with that? There is a profound problem with that.
Not everybody's a Christian.
You can't have a Christian society if you don't have Christians. Okay? You can't. They understood that. So they're trying to figure out, well, what that must mean then is that we have to figure out how to make these people who are sort of in, sort of out, members of the community. And so that's really what they did. So good, as good Calvinists, they baptized their children of the covenant. But if all who were baptized were members of the covenant, how could purity of life and doctrine be safeguarded? How do you deal with keeping children on the straight and narrow, right? Most of us have had children. We all understand that path was not a straight one, right? And we were children once too. So if infants were baptized as children of the covenant, what was to be done with infants born of baptized parents who never experienced conversion? Okay, you see the implications of this. Where am I here? So they concluded, this is one of the really, there are two very bizarre things about the Puritans. This is the first one. The second one is even more bizarre. We'll get there in a minute. They came to the conclusion that there must be a halfway covenant. It embraces those who, having been baptized, they're still members of the covenant, but still only those who had a conversion experience could be full members of the church. Right? We function this way in American evangelicalism. All right? All my Baptist friends, I give them a hard time all the time. I tell them that they just practice dry baptisms because there's absolutely no reason for them to do dedications. There is none. Because in the theology of conversion, those children, well, you have two options. Children are either just little sinners waiting to get converted, or they are innocent. Right? So you have lots of churches that just teach that children until a certain age, whatever that age might be, are not guilty. Okay? Now, I have a hard time reading the scriptures and finding that anywhere. Okay? But you have this notion of what do we do with these ones who have been baptized, not converted, so we make this idea of, well, you still need a conversion experience. Some Presbyterian churches function this way. I see it, I read minutes for, we review churches' minutes for the presbytery. And often churches will fail to recognize children baptized in the church. What do we call them? We call them members. We call them members. They're baptized members. Now, we do make a distinction. They're non-communing members, but they are members. And a lot of times I hear people, or I see it in the minutes, reflecting this notion that they're somehow not members. No, they are members. Based on this covenant, all right? It's not that we don't want to understand someone's profession of faith, all right? But the challenge is, if I insist on a conversion experience, none of my three children would be admitted as members of the church. Why not? Because they didn't have a conversion experience. They didn't have a aha, right? They grew up understanding God loved them, that they were part of God's family, that they were part of the covenant family of God, and that they belonged to God. It's really hard for us to sort of grasp that because we have just grown up in a culture where we will poo-poo Arminianism, that this notion that somehow I have to agree to allow God to save me, but then we turn around and act that way when we make conversion the determining factor on how I'm saved. Am I saved because I experience a conversion? No. No, why am I saved? Why are you saved? Because God called you, elected you, justified you, sanctifies you, and ultimately will glorify you. Right? And so the Puritans are struggling with this idea of having this conversion experience as part of what it means to be a Christian, and at the same time understanding that God is the one who does all of those things. And so they're just trying to sort through it all. I didn't mean to go down that road, sorry. This led to lots of bitterness in the communities in New England. I think in many respects, the three most godless states in the United States, Vermont, New Hampshire, Maine, those are the three least churched, godless societies, states in the United States. Okay? California is not even close. Not even close. Yeah. Now, the difference between California and New England is in California, those who are non-Christians are vocal and often adamant that you shouldn't put that in my face. In New England, they don't give a damn. They just don't. This is now. On any given, this morning in New England, there will be about 3% of the population who will get up and go to any kind of service. Any kind of service.
So that includes satanic
kind of service. Yes, it does. Yes. Yes. Yeah. I'm convinced that it's because of these, this false teaching that worked its way into the Puritans. Because they somehow made this distinction, and the whole conversion experience. I mean, when we lived in South Carolina, everybody I met was a Christian. Well, of course they. You know, I mean, some of them had been had walked an aisle 6 or 7 times, been baptized 3 times. I mean, heck, they were, you know, but they had no relationship with the church. They had nothing, right? Because again, we make it about that conversion experience rather than about God's grace in our lives. Yes?
Well, the best you could say, there's a lot of poor teaching there, but I wanted to ask, so the Puritans, did they actually articulate a doctrine that explains this halfway?
They tried, yes, they did. So there were documentations. Most of the documents related to the halfway covenant were more concerned not so much with how do we relate to these folks, but how do they become members of the society. That was their primary concern, because if you have a baptized child who grows up but doesn't walk in the church, he can't be a member of the town. He can't be a member in society. And so that was what they were really wrestling with. So most of it has to do with that. Because again, for them, they're trying to establish this Christian society. And you, in order to have a Christian society, you have to have Christians. Okay? You had to be a member of a church in good standing in order to vote. Of course, only men could have any of those, right? Women weren't actually members of the church. They were... How was a woman a member of a church back then? She had two ways. Either her husband or, if she wasn't married, her father. Those are the only ways that a woman could be a member. She had no vote, no voice. It's funny, I was reading through our Book of Church Order, and at the end of ordination and installation services, it says that ordinarily the heads of household will greet the new ordained minister. It's still there, okay? It's still there. I am not a patriarchal guy. I have some friends that are. I do believe God makes man the head of households, but that doesn't give him any right to rule and do inordinate things. All it says is, you're more responsible. That's what it says. Okay? All right, we'll never get done here. As more and more of these children grew up, having been baptized, but not going to any kind of church, it sort of defeated the purpose. The whole system sort of collapsed upon itself. By the time you get to the early 18th century, 1710, 1720, 1730, more than 50% of the people in New England aren't attending any church. Again, we have this rosy picture of what it means to be an early American colonist. And it's not much different than it is today. That's why we have a Great Awakening in the middle 18th century. But that ran out of steam by the time we get to the Revolutionary War. Again, there's a decline in Christianity in America, right? Which means, by the way, when we see what we see today, we rather than, you know, being Chicken Little, the sky is falling, we ought to say, you know, God can do another work. He can, and I pray he does. All right, so finally, the majority settled on congregational rule. Rather than trying to have a Christian society, we'll just let each church figure it out on their own. That has had lasting implications even in Presbyterianism. We'll talk about that when we get to the 19th century. They were limited by the need for all congregations to agree to a confession of faith, and that confession of faith was the Westminster Confession of Faith. So every little congregational church in all of New England had as their founding document the Westminster Confession of Faith, which is why there are a number of congregational churches that have been joining back to the Presbyterian Church, because essentially their doctrine is the same as ours, except for a couple of things related to church government. Once they work through that, they come into the PCA. Arnie Brevik, some of you know Arnie. Arnie pastored a little congregational church in Limington, Maine. And that church is now an Orthodox Presbyterian church because it was slowly making its way back. All right. Anybody know what's going on here? Well, they're yeah, why would you put women in the stocks? Ah, yes, the witch. This is the most controversial issue in all of New England. This has theologians and historians scratching their heads as to how on earth did this happen? This doesn't fit our theology very well. It's not to say that we dismiss any satanic or supernatural work of the devil. We don't. But we don't do this. This was bizarre, okay? 1692, actually the winter of 1691, so it was probably November, a bunch of girls, almost said something I probably would regret. When little girls get together, like many little girls, they like to talk. Yes? Most men speak about 15,000 words a day, and most women speak about 30,000 words a day. Just FYI. So these girls start talking, and they start making these wild accusations about some of the people in their society. And rumors start circulating. Okay, what's another name for rumor, by the way? Gossip. Oh, it's gossip, yeah. So there are a number of things that are going on here that shouldn't have been going on. That's not to say that we struggle with this in a different level, because the church has sort of overreacted to this notion of idle accusations, as it relates to sexual predators. The church has done a horrible job of hearing little children say things that are, from our perspective, unbelievable, and we have dismissed them. Now, what's interesting to me is, so we had that sort of reaction. We've now gone the other way. Now all it takes is anybody to say anything, and now you're accused. And now you're now not only are you accused, you are guilty. Right? We've got to have balance in these things. All right? So these girls make these wild accusations, and rumors begin circulating that witchcraft is going on in Salem. Any of you been to Salem, Massachusetts? It's a quaint little town. It's interesting. So 1692, you have rumors that eventually lead to hysteria. In total, 20 people were hanged. Several others died in prison. There were 14 women and 6 men in total in that community. It's interesting, and Andy shared this with me from the Smithsonian Institute, and it's intriguing to me. This woman wrote this, I don't know if she did a dissertation, but she posits, Linda Caporeal, she posits the theory that these bewitched girls actually suffered from what is called ergot poisoning. Ergot is a fungus that loves to grow on grain. And the weather during this winter would have been ideal for ergot to grow on the wheat that they were ingesting. It's again, you have to ask yourself, how on earth did they get here? How did these leaders of the community get to a place where they're listening to these wild accusations of these little girls with no evidence? There was no evidence. That they had these wild notions that God, well, you know, it's sort of the mantra, you know, we'll kill them and God will sort it out in the end kind of thing. It's just fascinating. It didn't last very long. Essentially, over a 20-year period, it sort of waned as they went along. Eventually, and this is really what sort of turned it, accusations were leveled against some of the major clergy, some of the merchants, and even the governor's wife. And when the governor's wife got accused, guess what happened? It stopped. Yeah, it stopped. There was hysteria to the level of, you know, I saw David and he was walking down the street and he was just talking and there was nobody around him. He's possessed by the devil, right? You know, I tell everybody that comes in my office, unless I address you, you don't need to respond because I'm just talking to myself, right? But it was that kind of thing that was going on, and it just became nuts. Anyway, yes. Well, it does. It produces hallucinations. Yeah.
It also caused the symptoms that they had.
Yeah.
And stuff like that.
Right. Right. I mean, yeah. Right. So you also had people that were, you know, they were acting crazy. They were having sort of seizure-like things, and so all of those things sort of, it might be. You know, again, who knows? It's
everybody eat it?
Well, yeah, everybody ate the grain. Everybody ate the grain. Yeah. Well, again, not everybody's grain would have been affected by it.
Right,
right, right. Yeah, it's an intriguing theory, so. All right, moving on. We have more controversies. 1646, John Eliot began missionary efforts among the Mohicans. Good movie, Last of the Mohicans, the early one, not the later one. I didn't like the later one. He was convinced, and this is going to play itself out with a later New Englander by the name of Joseph Smith, okay, who picked up some of these ideas. But he was convinced that the Indians were the 10 lost tribes of Israel, and that their conversion would bring about the fulfillment of all the ancient prophecies. This is just as crazy as thinking my neighbor's a witch, okay? It really is. He founded villages ruled by the law of Moses, that is the Ten Commandments. I mean, not only the Ten Commandments, but all of the dietary laws, all of those things. Which, by the way, also gave rise to another group of New Englanders who are led by a man, can't remember his first name, last name Miller, became known as the Millerites. And the Millerites ended up becoming what we now call the Seventh-day Adventists. And the Seventh-day Adventists follow what law?
Dietary.
Moses' dietary laws. Okay? Yeah, crazy, crazy. He did translate the Bible into Mohican, so he did something good. 1675, some of the Indians, under the leadership of a chief that called himself King Philip, decided to put an end to the outrage that was going on against them. So the conflict became known as King Philip's War, and it saw... What was interesting, so many of these Indians had been converted to Christianity, but what it saw was that many of the converted Indians took sides with the settlers or would refrain from fighting, right? They didn't want to be fighting against those who had brought the gospel to them, but as the settlers and continued to engage, what they did was they took all the Indians, didn't matter whether you were professing Christ or not, and they put them, they forced them into these terrible places. There's a little island in Boston Bay that basically was a rock, and they just put these people out there on the rock. Okay? Many of them were killed. And when the settlers finally won the war, the captive Indians... The captive Indians were distributed among the whites. Women and children became servants, and men were sold and shipped away. All right. These are the things that we need to remind ourselves. This is our history. This is our history. Yeah, we did not treat the natives very well here. And it's going to continue into the 20th century, by the way. Okay, let's see if we can start here. I don't know how much. Yeah, we can. Rhode Island and the Baptists. The religious intolerance of Puritan colonies, if you were, again, if you're a Puritan society, then in order to be a member of that society, you must be not a Christian. A Puritan. You must be a Puritan, okay? Which meant you must be a Calvinist, okay? And if you weren't, you weren't very welcomed. Because for a Calvinist, if you are teaching something other than Reformed faith, then you are a heretic, okay? I try to make distinctions between capital H and little h, okay? So this religious intolerance forced some in that society to abandon them. And the most famous of them was Roger Williams, who arrived in Massachusetts in 1631. He was asked to take a pastorate in Boston, and he refused, and he declared that the Puritans in the colony erred in granting the civil authority power to enforce those commandments that had to do with an individual's relation with God. How can society order or direct a man's conscience? Okay, you hear a theme here? This is going to play out. significantly 100 years later. He was convinced also that the land the colonies occupied belonged to the Indians, and that the entire colonial enterprise was unjust and illegal. Doesn't make for a, you know, warm, fuzzy relationship with those who are in New England. And so he becomes unpopular in Boston. And he moves to Plymouth, which is just down the coast, but away from Boston. Again, it's not like now where there's, if you drive from Boston to Plymouth, you don't really drive out of civilization. But then you did. Okay, so he went down to Plymouth. But then he was asked to take a pastorate in Salem. So he goes back up to Salem, but when he tried to have his church secede from the rest of the churches, the authorities in Massachusetts expelled him, put him out of Massachusetts. So again, he moves to Plymouth, and then he goes to Narragansett. Narragansett was a little island south of Massachusetts that is going to play a significant role here. It was land that he bought from the Indians, again, because he believed the Indians were the rightful owners. So he paid for that land. And he founded the colony of Providence on the principle of religious freedom. Williams believed that such freedom was required by the very obligation to worship God. Worship must be sincere, he argued, and all efforts to force it actually weakens it. Okay? Therefore, in the new colony, the rights of citizenship would not be abridged on the basis of one's religious opinions or practices. You can do whatever you want to be a citizen. That should have nothing to do with your religious persuasion. Okay? That should sound very familiar to you. He expounded these views in a treatise that he wrote in 1644. It was called The Bloody Tenet of Persecution for the Cause of Conscience Discussed. And yes, I did spell those correctly. One of the main pastors in Boston responded with his own treatise called The Bloody Tenet Washed and Made White in the Blood of the Lamb. Okay, one saying that a man's conscience is the ultimate decider of one's faith, and the other is saying the ultimate decider of one's faith is God and the work of Christ. You see that distinction going on here, okay? There were others who sort of popped up as well during this time. 1637, there was a prophetess named Anne Hutchinson, who was expelled from Massachusetts. She was put out about 5 or 6 times for various infractions. And the reason she was put out is because she said she received personal revelation. God told me. And usually when I have people, I said this in the sermon, usually when people say God told me, it has nothing to do with them. It has something to do with somebody else, right? It's interesting. She and 18 others founded Portsmouth, which was on the other end of the island of Providence. And again, the founding principle was religious freedom. We want to be allowed to do what we want to do. Shortly after that, a group from Portsmouth founded the community of Newport at the other end of the island. Anybody been to Newport, Rhode Island? It is just spectacular. Spectacular. All of these communities grew with an influx of Baptists, Quakers, and others. All of these non-Puritans, for the most part. But the only legal claim of these new settlements was based on the fact that they bought the land from the Indians. And many in the nearby colony spoke of destroying what they considered the sewer, of New England. If you read some of the writings of Massachusetts and Connecticut, they talk about this land, Narragansett, as the sewer of New England. So, Roger Williams travels to England, and in 1644 obtains from the Long Parliament, remember the Long Parliament, it was the one that was in session for 23 years, he got legal recognition of the colony of Rhode Island and Providence Plantations. You do know that that is the official name of that state. It is not Rhode Island. It is Rhode Island and Providence Plantations. You have lots of time spent in Rhode Island, in Barrington, and Providence. You worked in Providence, right?
I did. And my first job was in Providence.
Okay, okay.
They later bought the property in Barrington.
Oh, it was later. Okay, okay. And then they later joined with Gordon College. Interesting. Where am I here? All right, so William's Church in Providence, surprise, surprise, becomes Baptist. He's moving away from these Puritan ideals. One of the members of that congregation baptized Williams, who in turn baptized everyone else. And what kind of baptism would it have to be? It has to be immersion, okay? But Williams, this is telling, I think. Williams didn't stick around very long. His contacts with the Indians led him to declare that perhaps their religion was acceptable in the eyes of God, as was Christianity. And that in any case, they did not have to become Christians in order to be saved. Yes. He eventually concluded that all churches were false and that Scripture was to be understood in purely spiritual terms. He was the grandfather of Mary Baker Eddy, in spiritually, yes. these ideas got rooted in this ground, and you see them pop up in upstate New York with the Millerites and Joseph Smith, in Maine with Mary Baker Eddy. And you have, we love the idea of religious freedom. Yes? We love the idea, but the idea itself gave rise to all sorts of craziness. Because the ultimate guide to our religious life is whom? Or is who? Me. Right? Mary Baker Eddy starts a Bible study. They start reading the Bible together, and she decides that she understands the Bible better than anybody else has ever understood it in history. And you have Christian Science. Right? The Millerites all gathered on a hill because he decided that he understood exactly the moment when Jesus was going to return. Joseph Smith, he must have been eating mushrooms out in the wild, and he finds two golden tablets that he puts in a hat and puts his head in there and translates it. Okay? All of that grew out of this religious freedom. And it also left a society that has 3% of the people going to any kind of service this morning. Okay? So we have to be careful what we wish for. All right, let me see if I can quickly finish this. Baptist controversies. Some of the teachings of these Baptist churches coincided with the Anabaptists on the continent. Mostly we know them as Mennonites, right? Most Baptists did not derive such ideas from them, but rather, as they studied the New Testament, they came up with their ideas, okay? The Baptists of Providence, while they were in exile in the Netherlands, a number of these Baptists were also influenced by the followers of Jacob Arminius, and they became Arminians. And it led them to return to England, and then others remained in England and continued sharing a number of the Baptists were influenced by Arminianism and took it back to England, and others of them remained in England and continued sharing in the strict Calvinism. One of their sort of main people that they gave us is these Calvinist Baptists in England was Charles Haddon Spurgeon. Okay? So he is a in the heritage of these Calvinist Baptists. The Second London Confession of 1689 is the Westminster Confession of Faith with one chapter changed. Do you know which one? The baptism one, yes. It's quite interesting. So what ended up happening in the colonies is we had two groups of Baptists. One of them were called general, and one of them were called particular. Any of you heard this before? General Baptists were those who held with the Arminians that Jesus died for everybody. Generally, Jesus' death was general. Okay, so they're general Baptists. Those are the Baptists we most think about. Okay, the other were called particular Baptists, and they were particular because they held to Orthodox Calvinism and affirmed that Jesus died for whom? For the elect, and only for the elect. Okay, it's interesting in American Baptism and Baptist circles. We'll look at this. Some of these sort of came together, and they really came together in the Southern Baptist Convention, where you have general and particular Baptists living together, and it has not always been a healthy and sound or quiet agreement. Over the last 25 to 30 years, the particular Baptists in the Southern Baptist Convention have been the predominant leaders of the denomination. I would say that they're not the majority, but they're the predominant leaders. And so much of the Southern Baptist Church has been moving in a direction towards Calvinism. So you go to the Gospel Coalition or those types of things, and you'll find Southern Baptist guys there. Some of you read some of their stuff. I see it online. And they're Calvinist in every sense of the word. I don't know how long the Southern Baptist Church will be able to endure this. There are signs that it's coming apart. But those vestiges have remained. I'm trying to think. Cedarville College in Ohio. Some of you know Cedarville. It started out a particular Baptist college. It is not anymore. Many of the Baptists in New England were American Baptists. And what's interesting between the Southern Baptists and the American Baptists, the Southern Baptists, of course, they were all Baptists of one convention until what? Civil War. And then you had the Northern Church and the Southern Church. Southern Baptists were the Southern Church, was the Southern Church. The American Baptists have essentially, this is not true of every single church, but essentially have become one of the liberal mainline churches in America. I have a good friend who's an American Baptist pastor in Vermont, and he's quite sound biblically. And again, in Baptist circles, because every church is independent, congregational, you can have a wide variety of sort of understandings. There's no church saying this is what you must believe, because it's founded on religious freedom, and so you can have a wide variety of understandings. All right, I went five over. I need to quit. Any questions? I finished right on time, didn't I? How about that? Next week we'll look at Roman Catholicism in Maryland, and how that really transformed America, allowing the Roman Catholics to become one of the most significant groups of people in America. And religious freedom allowed that. It allowed that. Okay? All right, let's pray. Lord, thank you.